international spectrum and what listening to the show, you know this is Oktoberfest week. It's the beginning of Oktoberfest. And occasionally I do mention that I am somewhat of a follower of Oktoberfest. I have a quarter German in me. My grandfather migrated from Dusseldorf 1906, I think, when he was a kid. And he didn't really wear the Lederhosen, but I, in my adult years, took up the banter, and I bought a pair of Lederhosen about 20 years ago. And I would go to local events and see what was going on. But in the last decade here in San Francisco, they celebrate Oktoberfest, which, for those of you who don't know the true celebration, it was actually for the wedding of King Leopold of Bavaria and his wife. And it spun off and morphed into four weeks of celebration. In Munich, they celebrated the last 2 weeks of September and the first 2 weeks of October. And I'll tell you, that's a lot of partying going on there. But I haven't had a chance to go to Munich to see all the festivities. But out here in Northern California and San Francisco, they basically convert a pier, Pier 48, which is right on the bay, and they make it a beer garden. And each night they pack in about 5,000 people. And I really like it because they do a wonderful job. They have the trimmings and tree. They bring in trees and foliage. And they have a 27-piece band. They have traditional dance. And it's really kind of a cool thing because San Francisco is very cosmopolitan. And there's a lot of people that come over from Europe and just around the world to celebrate. And so last night was the first night. So I actually posted a photo of myself in my Lederhosen. People go, "Cliff, no, you're not wearing Lederhosen." And it's like, "Oh yeah, no, they're like, you know, they fit very well." So happy Oktoberfest. I hope everyone's doing well today. It's a lot of fun too. Wow. I mean, and they have Sunday in the city where the kids and the families come out too, and it's a lot of fun. I want to remind everyone that the Facebook page is the continual repository for fantastic material. I mean, it's growing thanks to a lot of you posting information. Jack Binter sent a gallery of a relative's trip into China. And this is a personal journey that shows not only these interesting pyramids that are scattered throughout China, but there's a tremendous amount of mounds, very old mounds that I wasn't familiar with. And we're not talking a few. We're talking what he predicts is many hundreds of mounds in parts of China that most people don't get to go to. And as China opens its doors to us, not only are we going to see more evidence of ancient mounds and what is contained within them, but also evidence of these pyramids. And some of these pyramids we know the contents of, and they're actually the burial mounds, massive burial mounds or pyramid-shaped mounds of rulers, and within those chambers in those pyramids are not only the crypt of the ruler, but also all kinds of very interesting artifacts, afterlife, furniture. In some cases, they have animals that were favorite animals that they kept. And you can see a great deal about this whole phenomenon of Chinese mounds and pyramids in a photo journal that I posted on the Facebook page. And to see that, you go to Facebook, go to Earth Ancients, go to Groups, and there's a really interesting photograph of one of these mounds that I've really never seen before. It's really well constructed. And it's similar to the mounds we have here in America and some of the ones you might see in South America, but the dirt and the way they packed it is very unique. So check that out. I posted an article that I wrote called "The Eyes Say It All: The Genius of Ancient Egyptian Sculpture." I reposted it as an article I wrote in 2013. And I want to point this out. I haven't talked about it. It's funny because I wrote it before I started this podcast. And I was fascinated by the reflective quality of these sculptures. And what they actually did is they took semi-precious stones and they placed those within these sculptures. And some of these sculptures are wood. Some of them are porcelain or clay. And they added obsidian and some other reflective stones in the eye. And what's very odd about these and very brilliant is that there's a quality of the eyes actually following you as you walk around. And I remember going to the Met in New York and seeing one of these sculptures, and it left a huge impression on me. And I did a little research, and a couple of scientists actually dissected and analyzed these eyes. And it's a piece of brilliant engineering, basically, how these eyes are not only very lifelike, but they also have a quality of actually seeing or looking. It appears like they are looking at you, and they follow you as you move. So the article's on the Facebook page. And you can go to Facebook Earth Ancients. Again, the article is called "The Eyes Say It All: The Genius of Ancient Egyptian Sculpture." I think you'll find it interesting. It's a short article. I'm hoping to have my website up when my web developer comes back from vacation. So it was going to be at the end of September. September is just about ready to be completed, I think. I hope to announce it the first week of October. But anyhow, these articles that I'm writing, I would prefer them to be on the website simply because there's so much more that you can see on the website, galleries and other people's articles and links to fantastic research that we just can't have on the Facebook page. But so I'll be announcing that soon. So check that out.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And this is kind of an interesting article that was posted recently on some reconstruction work that was done on a skeleton that was found in Peru. The face of Lord Sipion, who is a Mochi warrior priest, was reconstructed using a new type of software that actually scans the cranium, the skeletal remains of an individual, and they can approximate how this guy looked. And this is a 2,000-year-old skull that was analyzed, and it was a 3D computer graphic reproduction of this individual, and it's just amazing what they were able to do. The skull was fairly fragmented, and they were able to, through computer scans, reconstruct the skull and then virtually apply the skin over the skull. And you see this individual, and he's pretty fierce looking, but it's quite interesting because his burial chamber is fairly significant. He has a lot of gold pieces, a lot of jewelry, a lot of his... actually, just some pieces of furniture they found were quite interesting too. But check this out. It's on the Facebook page. You can see the entire reconstruction. You can see the details of what they did with his remaining skull and fragments of his body. And it's quite fascinating. Technology is providing us with quite a good look at a lot of people that passed away thousands of years ago. And it's, who knows? I mean, I just read an article the other day where they found the remains of an individual that had enough tissue left that they could approximate how he talked. We'll talk a little bit about that in the future. And they were able to actually reproduce sounds from his voice, and they made this person talk, which is kind of scary. It makes you wonder, what are they going to do in the future? They'll probably completely reconstruct the individual, and we'll get an approximation, which might be kind of cool. You know, wow, that's just the thought of that's pretty amazing. So check it out, Facebook, Earth Ancients. Go to the group page, and it's all there for you to check out. So that's what we're all about. Hey, it's getting to be that time of year where it's time to make plans for trips to the Asian area, to Europe. I'm going to be going to Paris in December to check out the great museums. And I have Bruce Cunningham. We've had Bruce on the show before with Ancient Mysteries International, and he does some fantastic tours into Indonesia. Bruce, how you doing today?
Hey there, Cliff. Doing real well.
Great. Glad to have you with us. Hey, tell us about this tour that you're putting together. I'm interested in learning more.
Okay, basically, it's part of the ASEAN, which is the group of many countries in Southeast Asia, includes Australia, New Zealand, some others, Advanced Archaeology Symposium. And before the symposium that will be the end of April, 22 through the 25th, we will actually be going to, 27th through the 30th. On the 22nd to the 25th of April, we will be going to Angkor before the symposium. And mm-hmm. I've just assembled an amazing team. I've got Dr. Sam Osmanovich going, Dr. Carmen Bolter, Michael Tellinger, Dr. Danny Hillman, Klaus Dona. Probably two other dozen. I could keep naming names. You know, if you get on the, you know, on my Facebook, the Ancient Mysteries International, you can see it. And the website for the tour is bodymindspiritjourneys.com. Mm-hmm. And it's quite amazing. The entire event without air is under $900. Two different countries with all those amazing speakers. And
so they
got
to get themselves out there, and then you taxi them around to these various areas, or how do they get around?
Basically, once you're there, it's pretty much all-inclusive. The Philippine event is 100% inclusive. The Angkor event is breakfast included and everything inclusive except for lunch and dinner, which can be as cheap as $1.50 there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's very inexpensive in that part of the world, isn't it?
Yes, and very healthy. All your meats have no steroids, hormones, antibiotics. All vegetables have no herbicides. It's healthier than is believable for those of us in the poison area of the States here.
Let me ask you a question. A lot of these conferences, and I just attended one here in the Bay Area, have a lot of these people Skyping in. Are you going to have a group of people Skyping in, or are they all going to be there in the flesh?
Nope, they're all going to be there in the flesh.
Now, that's pretty amazing because that's a lot of exceptional talent that you're bringing to the plate there. So why don't you give us the dates again, and what's the title again of this
conference? Okay, it's the ASEAN, A-S-E-A-N, Advanced Archaeology Symposium 2017.
Wow. Fantastic.
It's great to have all those people. Basically, we're just developing a team of people that want to work, you know, researchers that want to work together, mm-hmm. and let's solve the mysteries of the ancients. I mean, that's part of the program anyway.
Yeah, sounds fascinating. Okay, well, they can go to your website, and what was the website again?
bodymindspiritjourneys.com.
Okay, that's pretty
easy to remember. They can also find the poster and some other information on the Ancient Mysteries International Facebook page. And if they want to email me for private information, it's on the poster, but it would be bruce@ancientmysteriesinternational.org.
Okay, fantastic. Sounds like a great program you've pulled together. Love to see some video of that, so hopefully you can get some of that to us after for a price.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Dr. Carmen will be doing all the video for her new series, The New Atlantis, and James Swagger is going to be live streaming the conference itself. So, yes,
fantastic.
It should be really cool.
Sounds good, Bruce. Sounds like a good one. Well, hey,
yes,
good luck with
that. We need to get Cliff Dunning there, though. I know that.
I think I'm going to be in Mexico, actually, and but we'll talk about it. We'll see. I'm definitely
going
to get out there.
We're definitely going to get Frank
We had Danny on last week, so Danny was talking about the pyramids there, and, of course, you have the wonderful Gunung Penang pyramid. I definitely got to check it out. So
yes, fantastic. Yes, for sure. Yeah, Danny Irwanto will also be part of the group that's at the symposium in Angkor.
Good deal.
Oh, yeah.
All right,
quite
Bruce.
Amazing.
Like a great program. Thank you.
All right. Talk to you later, Cliff. Thanks.
Okay. Bye. Yeah, that sounds like a really good program. I think I've announced that I'm going to be in Mexico the latter part of April. So, sounds like a good one. Yeah, we talk a great deal about ancient America on this program, and we have had Native Americans talking about the migration, their ancestors' migration. And for years, there's just tremendous amount of speculation about who the early settlers were. This is prior to the natives that we know about. And there's a lot of evidence in the form of artifacts, in the form of structural ruins from unknown civilizations that continually I don't want to say suppressed, but just they're not reported by mainstream news agencies. And recently, we've had a number of individuals on this show talking about actual hard evidence. Some of these people are research investigators. We've had people talk about the Templar Knights, giants that roamed the East Coast, and now seems like they're almost in every state. There's evidence of giant human beings. But a lot of these discoveries are dated thousands of years before Columbus was even considered. And it makes you think about America, the United States that we live in, I live in, and why we don't know more about this information, why it hasn't come out with any great clarity. My guest today is Frank Joseph, and we've had Frank on the show before. And I'm not sure I mentioned this, but Frank was the editor-in-chief of Ancient America magazine. And I think he still, and we'll have to ask him, he still has quite a hand on working with that publication. And he's come out with a fascinating new book called The Lost History of Ancient America, How Our Continent Was Shaped by Conquistadors or Conquerors, Influencers, and Other Visitors from Across the Ocean. I'm going to read just the beginning of this introduction, just to give you an idea of what we're going to talk about today. And this book is fascinating. And this is the introduction. This book is a breakthrough. Never before and nowhere else has so much valid evidence been assembled on behalf of overseas visitors in America before Columbus. Presentations offered here are not speculation, exaggeration, or out of context half truth. Instead, they establish beyond question the transoceanic travelers to our continent explored and exploited its hundreds and thousands of years prior to Santa Maria's late 15th century landfall in the Bahamas. Frank, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be back here as always.
Yeah, it's really, this is a fantastic book, Frank. I want to talk to you a little bit about it. Your years at Ancient America magazine are really well focused here. You chose You chose a number of outstanding articles as well as many of your own to comprise this book. And I have to ask you, you use a term in here that I'm familiar with known as diffusionism or diffugism. Can you talk a little bit about what that means and why it's important to understand in the context of this book?
Well, it's referred to as cultural diffusionism, and that means that it belongs to someone who concludes that the oceans of the ancient world were not barriers between continents, but rather highways that connected them. And a cultural diffusionist is someone who is opposite someone known as a cultural isolationist. A cultural isolationist says, no, maritime technology did not exist sufficiently in pre-Columbian times to enable people to sail very long distances, and as a consequence, their societies developed pretty much in isolation. But I think that this paradigm of cultural isolationism has been so thoroughly undermined that any logical thinking person presented with the evidence would have to conclude that people sailed around the world for hundreds and thousands of years before Columbus ever set sail, and that these connections formed the societies that we know today. And that's why it's important. It's not just history, something that happened a long time ago we don't know anything about. What you're seeing today is the end result of these connections that have been, in many cases, subtly intertwined since really the beginning of a civilized man, or even before civilized man. We can go back all the way to the Ice Age and before and see these tremendous connections between peoples and continents. And just one example of that, which even mainstream scholars accept, is that more than 40,000 years ago, now we're talking an inconceivable length of time in the past, 40,000 years ago plus, it's established, it's known, that peoples from Indonesia sailed across the sea to Australia. That is how Australia became populated. Australia has not been connected to any mainland for millions of years. And yet we can trace the origins of the Aboriginal peoples back to their forefathers who crossed enormous lengths, broad, vast vistas of seas in order to reach Australia. And this was done 40,000 years ago. And believe me, if the ancestors of the Australian peoples could have done this, other peoples definitely could and did do the same sorts of journeys that contributed to what we are today.
Right. Now, you open the book with probably the most solid evidence of this world travel, and that is plant crops. Can you give us a couple of examples? And as an example, I will just bring one up. There's quite a bit of evidence of ancient Egyptians using tobacco and, of course, cocaine, which is found in South America and Central America. And there's great speculation about how it got to Egypt. But you go into quite a bit of depth. Can you give us a couple of examples of plant crops that are found in areas that are not indigenous to its original growth?
I should say just before I begin here, I did not write this article. It was written by a very brilliant scholar, Dr. Carl Johansson, who has been studying this problem of finding plants that originate in various parts of the world that could not physically have transplanted themselves over great stretches of the ocean. And one of the ones that he mentions, to answer your question, is one called Datura. It's called the thorn apple. It's a plant, or it's Jimson weed. It's all the Datura species. And their origins are entirely in Eurasia. They have never been found outside of this area unless they have been brought by travelers. And Dr. Johansson has shown that this strictly Eurasian plant, thorn apple or the Jimson weed, was literally transplanted to the American Southwest about 3,000 years ago, probably a little longer ago than that. Mm-hmm. That would place the appearance of Jimson wheat entirely from Eurasia in the southwest of the Americas about the end of the last Bronze Age. Now, that's very important because even established mainstream scientists admit that the science of navigation had reached very high levels during the late Bronze Age, and that ships did travel very far. Of course, this is the time of the Trojan War, most famously, with its 1,000 ships. And we are seeing now the appearance. Datura isn't the only one, but Datura is the most incontrovertible example of a plant which was strictly located in Eurasia, one part of the world, which could have only been transported. No way could it have been wafted across in the air or across the sea. Mm-hmm. It had to have been moved by somebody. And it takes place at the same time that all this great seafaring is taking place. Mm-hmm. There are numerous examples, and I think that that's one reason why we wanted to include Dr. Johansson's article right in the beginning, because the arguments he brings up for these various plants, one after the other, are just incontrovertible. I mean, I would love to be able to see a critic stand up and say, no, you're wrong here, Dr. Johansson, we're not sure of this, but the evidence is actually, the rest of the book is kind of downhill from that. And the rest of the book is almost like an anecdote, because after you get past that article about Dr. Johansson's plant transference, it's like, well, of course they were here. Of course people arrived here. The most incredible thing in Dr. Johansson's article I found personally was the peanut. And the peanut was developed entirely in China, very localized in very small areas of China. And because it was like a gourmet crop, it was only for the king and his family, that sort of a thing. And the peanut shows, and it was developed about a very long time ago, right at the very beginning of Chinese dynastic history. You mentioned before in the introduction about these Chinese pyramids and mounds. The pyramids in China are incredible. They approximate the size of the Great Pyramid in Egypt, and even the configuration and everything. We don't know much about them because the Chinese authorities have been very secretive about them, but what we do know is incredible. Yeah. But what's amazing is these pyramids they sort of sprang into existence at the same time that all this highly advanced agriculture was also taking place in China, in that same area. And the peanut appears just a couple of centuries after it was actually invented, it was genetically configured. It appears, again, in the American Southwest. And there is absolutely no way that this peanut could have gotten from central China to the southwest of North America about 4,000 years ago. I mean, that's it. Now we're talking really far back in time. We're talking about the very origins of Chinese history, and yet the peanut, which was invented in China, appears just a few centuries later in North America. So I think that it's astounding. Not only does Dr. Hansen show that this could never have been transferred by accident or natural processes, but that it appeared so long ago. And that's an indication that people traveled around the globe very far back in civilized history.
Frank, why does it take so long for orthodoxy to grasp these concepts? I mean, here's solid evidence of the peanut being created in China thousands and thousands of years ago, and then it shows up in the United States and probably other parts of the world, and yet we don't really, you know, without your book and your research, we really don't know about it. Why would you say there's just because it's just people are lazy, or that change just takes time? What do you
say? I think that's an excellent question, and I don't presume to be able to answer it definitively. I'm not a psychologist, but I would attribute it just to human nature. And in the long run, I believe this process is good, that there is a lot of skepticism and even suppression of evidence. There's no doubt. I've been associated with Ancient American Magazine for well over 20 years now, and I can tell you that there are concerted efforts on the part of established archaeologists to not just dismiss this evidence like this, but to actually suppress it. But that is human nature, and I think that in the long run, this is going to be very good because it will show that we have to come up with some really tough arguments. We just can't suggest in a logical way, well, you know, the ancients had ships, so they must have been over here. We are forced, because of the hostility of mainstream archaeologists, to really do our homework. And so when we publish a book like this, we better know exactly what we're talking about. So I think the process is good. It is the nature of science, I think, to resist new unorthodox ideas. They are pounced upon, sometimes savagely, but in the long run, the truth always prevails. So I think it's a winnowing process. It's a good process. And I don't complain because people poo-poo these things or criticize us or call us lunatic fringe scientists and so on. That's perfectly all right. The only thing that matters is that this information is made available to thinking people like yourself, Chris, who can have the intellectual capacity to look into these things in an unbiased fashion and draw their own conclusions. That's all we can do. But I don't presume to try to explain what's going on in the heads of these mainstream scholars. The only thing you can say is that, of course, a great number of them write their own textbooks for their students.
Yeah.
And they sell these textbooks to their students. That's part of their income. Archaeologists don't make much money unless you're a state archaeologist. And even then, they don't do that well. And so for somebody like us to stand up and say, oh, no, your textbooks are all wrong, well, you're undermining their economic base. And so naturally they're not going to be too happy about that. But that's not important.
Right. Hey, this book, The Lost History of Ancient America, is packed full of fantastic short articles and references and material. I want to touch on a couple and get your insight into why you chose him for this book, because it's quite a fun book to read. It's a quick read, but you have a lot of great material in here. So let's start with a unique bone that was found in Florida that has images of a woolly mammoth on it, and it's quite an eyesight for that.
Yes, it is. It's incredible. It's an actual representation, an eyewitness representation, eyewitness drawing that somebody made of a woolly mammoth, and of course that animal became extinct about 10,000 years ago. So here we have some representational art of someone who actually saw one of these creatures, and that was removed from a lake, up kind of a bog, a sinkhole type of thing in Florida. The reason why I included that particular article, even though it doesn't really deal with what we've been talking about, the culture diffusionism, it shows how science forgets, and how sometimes, and I mean this really in a positive way, because everybody is ignorant to some degree, certainly myself, how ignorant scientists can be. Because when this bone was found, this engraved representation of a woolly mammoth, the scientists thought, wow, this is terrific. This is the first time anything like this has ever been found. It's a major discovery. Well, they forgot that at least seven other drawings of woolly mammoths have been found over the past 150 years. And when these drawings were found, they were inevitably savaged by mainstream scientists saying, oh, no, they're all fake. Why are they fake? Well, because they must be fake. And that's as far as the argument ever went. No one ever really studied or looked into them. Well, we did at Ancient American. We examined these drawings of these mammoths. Most of them still exist. Some of them are petroglyphs that have been found. out in Arizona. And so what we're, and the most amazing one was found about 7 years ago underwater in Lake Michigan, about really not too far off the shore of Indiana, I believe, by a certified archaeologist. So the reason I included that article is, I wanted to show that mainstream science isn't always to be trusted. And it's a great I think, story. Anyway, what I tried to do with this book was to supply, as you mentioned, brief articles, short ones, offering a great variety of material rather than just hammering away at the same thing, which can get kind of dull, I guess, repetitive. So I wanted to get as much different points of view, different aspects of this problem as possible.
Yeah. No, I mean, the book is really fun to read because you give enough content so someone really can, if they want to continue reading, they can go do a search and maybe pull up some of the reference material that you provide. I want to talk about something that fascinated me, and this is the discovery of mercury in one of the temples at Teotihuacan in Mexico, just south of Mexico City. I actually reported on this amazing discovery, but you took it one step further. The discovery was made in an excavation of the pyramid, or they call it the Temple of the Feathered Serpent, which is... they're continually working on it. It's partially ruined, but they're still building it. But they dug underground, and they found quite a bit of evidence of mercury deposits underneath the actual pyramid. Can you talk a little bit about what you discovered? And I think it was fascinating. You actually describe how they created mercury.
Well, mercury is, of course, a dangerous thing to work with. It can extremely poisonous. And it was a shock to archaeologists, Mexican archaeologists, when they were in a place called Teotihuacan, which is the largest of all of the ancient cities in the Americas. Just absolutely gigantic. It was once believed there were 300,000 people that lived there, and now it's believed that upwards of 500,000 people. Imagine that, 500,000 people into an organized state. We're talking about, anywhere from 2,000 or more years ago up to about maybe 1,000 or so years ago. And the center of Teotihuacan is the Avenue of the Dead, as it's referred to. And along the Avenue of the Dead, this tremendously huge and impressive boulevard to walk down it is fabulous, this stone boulevard. There are pyramids on either side. Three of them predominate. One is the Pyramid of the Sun, which is absolutely gigantic, made out of very difficult to work lava stone, terrific masterpiece. Then there's the Pyramid of the Sun, of the Moon rather, which is somewhat smaller, also magnificent. And then there's the Pyramid of Quetzalcoatl, or the Pyramid of the Feathered Serpent. Now the Feathered Serpent is a figure that permeates all of pre-Columbian cultures south of the Rio Grande. And he is regarded as the founding father of civilization in the Americas by the ancients. He's portrayed in myth, and in not just in myth, but in their histories. There's a Mayan history called the Popol Vuh, the Book of Council, which describes the Feathered Serpent. He's called the Feathered Serpent because of the headgear that he wore, which suggests an Egyptian pharaoh, because the headwear that he wore was a feathered serpent. Well, that's exactly what the uraeus was. The uraeus was the royal garment, headgear, rather, of Pharaoh, which showed a feathered serpent. Mm-hmm. And Quetzalcoatl is described as this tall, fair-haired, fair-skinned, light-eyed man who arrived after a terrific catastrophe at sea with his followers and family. And they brought the high technology of this former kingdom that he sailed away from and interworked with the native peoples to create Mesoamerican civilization. And his chief pyramid there in Teotihuacan is a masterpiece in itself, but it's been found underneath are these artificial man-made rivers of liquid mercury. Mm-hmm. Why on earth would anybody go to the enormous trouble of working with this dangerous and, for the most part, unseen commodity The pyramids contain many mysteries. Now, liquid mercury is part of it. In the pyramid, right across the Avenue of the Dead from the pyramid of Quetzalcoatl, was found these enormous thin flakes of mica that had been transported at great difficulty in the ancient times all the way from Brazil. And why would, again, people go to the trouble of including something like that in an area that would not be seen, by the way? This was not used for ceremonial purposes that can be understood. There were no one had access to either the liquid mercury or these enormous wafers of mica. Well, both of these commodities, if you want to refer to them as that, the liquid mercury and the mica, they have electrical properties. And that liquid mercury and especially crystals are used on electronic technology today.
Exactly.
That would seem that
they
had some kind of a knowledge, some kind of a basic fundamental grasp of the properties of electricity. What exactly they used this for, that does not appear that they wanted to illuminate anything, but perhaps to create some kind of magical effects. But nonetheless, it shows that these Maya engineers did grasp the fundamentals of electricity, because there seems to be no other possible explanation why you would go to the trouble of including this rather dangerous material in regards to the liquid mercury, unless there was some kind of electronic property involved. And the article goes and discusses that, at least poses this question for others to take up.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating discovery, and I've known about it since they uncovered it. It shocked the Mexican scientists as to why this sophisticated liquid would be found underneath this pyramid. And it makes you wonder, is there other pyramids that have this quantity underneath it? You mentioned that the article writes discusses how mercury is made. And can you talk a little bit about that? Because that, I think that's kind of interesting, how they made mercury.
Well, you know, as I recall, there are different ways that. Pardon me?
Wasn't it cinnabar or something that they melted or something that they created mercury from? It's something very interesting. I wasn't familiar with it.
Right. Well, the creation of liquid mercury, the way they made it possibly, is from cinnabar, which is this material, this mineral, which is available in large quantities in Mexico. So I don't think anybody is saying that, they had to import their liquid mercury from overseas. It looks as though that it was, in fact, made in the Valley of Mexico. However, the technology for making it maybe originated elsewhere, because another place where the liquid mercury has been found in large quantities is, again, in China, in Shaoxing, which is the site for the largest of the known pyramids in China. And one of the few things we do know from the Chinese archaeologists that were allowed to excavate part of it is that they did find, as they said, and I'm quoting from them, rivers of liquid mercury inside Shoshin's Great Pyramid. Why these things were done, it's difficult to tell. The archaeologists in China speculated that the liquid mercury was used to replicate rivers in these models that supposedly exist inside Shoshin's Great Pyramid. Apparently there's a great model of the kingdom that ruled central China at that time, and that the liquid mercury was used to replicate lakes and rivers and things like that. But then again, it seems kind of unlikely, because liquid mercury, even to be around it, can be a poisonous affair. And certainly if it's handled, it can be lethal. So they created it from cinnabar. It's a simple process, a relatively simple process. Once it's known, it's simple. But then the technology, the technological know-how to even understand and to use this, it at least suggests a very high level of culture that arose in Mexico at that time.
Yeah, it's fascinating when you see something like mercury in these pyramids. It really I don't know if you know the work of John Burke, but before he passed away, he did a tremendous amount of scanning of pyramids in Mexico and in Egypt, and discovered that a lot of them were built over geomagnetic fields, naturally occurring pulsing fields. And he didn't correlate the two, Mercury and these fields, but I think that there is something about that. There's something to that correlation. And we don't know how many of this pyramid culture of the Maya, and then now we know the Chinese were, you know, earlier in their history were a pyramid culture. If they were built for conducting energy, for generating some kind of energy, we have no clue. But it's a lost science that's fascinating to discover, and be great to know that they had electricity, because it changes our whole understanding of the ancient past. So it's a
well, there is a suggestion why they may have used electricity, and it wasn't to, like I said, to illuminate their streets or anything like that. There was a British archaeologist by the name of Paul McCartney, not the Beatle, Paul McCartney, back in the 1960s, he also did a survey similar to the one that Burke did. And what he did is he made an exhaustive study of all of the known megaliths in Britain and in Western Europe. And, of course, there are thousands of them. And he did a correlation of these megaliths and their positions. And what he found were two interesting things. One, virtually all, if not all, of the megaliths that were made, of course, these are referred to as Stone Age structures, like Stonehenge and so on, all of them, so far as he was able to determine, had large veins of quartz in them. Most of them were made of granite, and granite itself has a lot of crystalline properties. They either had large veins of quartz in them, or else they were quartz. The other thing is that these structures were all directly over fault zones. Some of them, like Karnak, were actually inserted, and this is in Brittany and Western France, were actually inserted into the fault zone. So there seems to be some kind of a relationship between quartz and tectonic forces, because if you squeeze quartz, if you exert mechanical pressure on quartz, you have a phenomenon known as piezoelectricity. This is the origins of our old radio sets, where you would turn a dial on the old radio sets in the 1920s. What that dial was inside the radio was just a little vise, and that vise put pressure on a crystal, a quartz crystal, which sparked and cause the radio to turn on. It's the same like today, these fire starters, these fire sticks, where you click them. When there's a click, there's a trigger that bangs into a little quartz crystal, which starts the fire. So it appears that these structures, this is just kind of speculation, we don't know for sure, but the evidence kind of suggests that both the megaliths in Western Europe and the liquid mercury with its crystalline wafers of mica produce some kind of a relationship with the tectonic forces at work underneath them. When you do that, you create something called the Andes glow. I don't want to get too much far afield on this, but
yeah,
when you create these kind of electrical fields, they produce huge amounts of negative ions. And if you step into one of these fields of negative ions, you go through a kind of a psychological altered state of consciousness. It's used in anesthesia today, negative ion therapy. Anesthesia is used for patients in hospitals that are resistant to normal forms of anesthesia. And it creates a serenity. People have dreams about angels and things like that. So it's possible that these induced fields of negative ions were used to create a spiritual atmosphere, or put people in a conducive mood. That's very possible. That's why they were
fascinating. Made. Yeah, we just don't know. Hey, let's return back to the States. And there's a really interesting article about a discovery made underneath Wisconsin Lake in 2011. A number of stones were discovered that made up what appears to be foundations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There have been several lakes in Wisconsin that have yielded some really interesting archaeological finds, because to be underwater, they had to be there, they had to be made a very long time ago. One of the more interesting ones is in southern Wisconsin, a place called Rock Lake. Rock Lake is located between Madison and Milwaukee, and more towards Madison. And actually, going way back to the 19th century, early pioneers heard from local Native Americans, the Sioux in that area, who talked about a village at the bottom of the lake. And sometime around the turn of the 20th century, when lake levels were very low because of a prolonged drought in the area, people claimed to have actually seen these pyramidal stone structures at the bottom of Rock Lake. And ever since then, professionals and amateurs alike have been looking for these structures. And it turns out that a number of them have been seen and found, and it is pretty well verified that there are these stone pyramidal structures at the bottom of this lake in southern Wisconsin. No one knows who built these things, when or why, but the Native Americans in the area attribute them to outsiders who came long ago. It's a fascinating discovery that needs to be more further exploited. Local archaeologists will admit, at least privately, that these structures exist, but it's very costly to go and examine them. Underwater archaeology is like triple the costs of archaeology on land.
Right.
So it's, the lake also is very turbid. It's not a very large lake. It's only like about 40 feet deep, maybe three quarters of a mile across and a little more than a mile long. But the, like most lakes in the upper Midwest, they're very turbid. Underwater conditions are not at all clear. Mm-hmm. But so when conditions do clear up from time to time, these things are seen and have been photographed. So,
so there's no carbon dating that's been done in any of the area close to these foundations.
Right. There has been carbon dating done to an area less than 3 miles away from Rock Lake. There is a major ceremonial center called Aztalan, and this was, until fairly recently, until about 700 years ago, this was a true city. It had three encircling palisaded walls with watchtowers, had three pyramids. The number three was repeated throughout this site, Aztalan. It was something represented like about 50 square acres. The people there grew outstanding crops. The pyramids there, one is called the Pyramid of the Sun, like the one in Mexico. The reason it's called that is because it was oriented to sunrise on the winter solstice. So these were kind of like the archaeoastronomer's dream. They really had a fabulous amount of orientation to various celestial phenomena. The other one is the Pyramid of Venus, because it's oriented to the rise of the morning star. And that place, Aztalan, is dated to from about 1200 A.D., maybe about 700 or 800 years ago. That's kind of a mystery there, because the people that lived there for all those centuries, they suddenly evacuated it and burned the entire place to the ground. They incinerated it. And how the relationship might be between Aztalan and the pyramids of the lake, no one has been able to know for sure. But the pyramids of the lake must have been made long before 1200 A.D., because lake levels, in order to accommodate the building of structures that are now 20 and 40 feet underwater, had to have been taken place thousands of years ago, not so hundreds of years ago. So we presume the people that built Aztalan were aware of those structures in the lake, and perhaps because they regarded it as sacred, decided to build their city there.
No, I mean, the basis of your great work on this magazine and the articles in there, Ancient America, is just the continual evidence of very early civilizations in what we now call the United States. And for years it was just, well, maybe someone showed up like the Vikings and then took off again. Well, no, you've shown that there's evidence of very advanced, very old, thousands and thousands of years before Columbus, civilizations here in what is now the United States. And I just continually are fascinated, and this is why this book, The Lost History of Ancient America, is fascinating for those of you who are living here in the States and are curious about its early discovery and early settlements. It's fascinating.
These structures that are in Rock Lake, by the way, they do resemble a type of pyramidal structure that's kind of unique outside of Egypt. And these are not the pyramids that we're mostly familiar with, the Great Pyramid and so forth. If we go south of Giza, or the Giza Plateau, where the pyramids are mostly, you go to a place called Nubia. It was called Nubia long ago. It's Sudan today. And they developed there a kind of a pyramid which was unlike a pyramid found anyplace else. It was very steep-sided. They were much smaller than the Great Pyramids of Egypt, but they were very beautiful and lovely, and they were obviously influenced a lot by Egyptian style. But nonetheless, they're very steep-sided. They look almost like obelisks. Well, those are the structures, strangely enough, that are seen at in the bottom of Rock Lake in Wisconsin. So is it conceivable that people from the ancient Sudan or Nubia had some kind of connection with Wisconsin so long ago? Again, we think about the Native American local tradition, which talks about these foreigners that arrived with this high technology and built the city of the dead, as they refer to it. They call it an acropolis. The Native Americans there are quite open about Rock Lake being a highly sacred body of water because of its city of the dead at the bottom of the lake. So there is that correlation, again, between other parts of the world. That, admittedly, is something that I don't touch upon too much in the book because it is pretty speculative. What I tried to do in The Lost History of Ancient America was to concentrate mostly on those pieces of hard evidence that we can say, yes, this is inescapable evidence. The other thing, the other article we have, as a matter of fact, the very first article is about the horse in America. And the this brilliant piece of workmanship that has been done by our contributor there it shows that the DNA evidence, the genetic evidence, shows that the horse was introduced to America long before Columbus. The fellow involved in this is Dr. Stephen E. Jones, who is an absolute expert, the top world-class expert in animal DNA comparisons. And his brief article makes it absolutely clear that there were various introductions of the horse over time. The most recent introduction of the horse was by the Vikings, the Norse, in the sometime in the 13th or 14th century. And then, but it was introduced long before then in other parts of America. So the horse is not something that was introduced only by the Spaniards 500 or so years ago. And that's also an indication that people weren't just shipwrecked here. They came here and they had intention of staying here and developing this place, and they did to a large extent. The big lesson that comes, I think, from the past that's applicable to us today is that these other high cultures rose and fell long before we were here, and that we don't have any kind of a special lease on history, that we are just the most recent example of a high culture that has been in North America. I think that's a great cautionary tale, because the question is, well, what happened to these cultures that were also high, these great civilizations that rose and fell? What mistakes did they make? Did they just get old and die out, or just did they make some error, some fundamental error? And if so, what errors might we make so that 2,000 or 1,000 years from now people will say, well, maybe there was a United States of America, maybe there wasn't, you know? There'd be the same kind of speculative question. Do we want to end up like that, totally forgotten, or else regarded as entirely legendary? So I think there's a lot more to think about than just plain history here. The comparison with our time, I think, is vital.
What do you say is the earliest evidence of culture, sophisticated culture in the United States? Would you say 2,000 years, 4,000 years? How far back would you comfortably say advanced culture was here in the United States?
This is something that I actually don't touch on in this book. I bring it up in another earlier book I wrote. It's called Before Atlantis. Mm-hmm. And the evidence there is absolutely mind-blowing. It is so radical that most people don't touch it, but the physical evidence for it cannot be explained away.
Mm-hmm.
So if our listeners are not willing to accept this, I can completely sympathize with them because I found it very difficult to accept until I looked into it. In Nevada, there is a Sierra. There is a high plateau. It's been studied by geologists for a very long time. And the reason why is because this plateau has some very level stratigraphy, and they're able to dig down into the past very confidently and show that hundreds of thousands and millions of years ago, these various strata were laid down in relatively peaceful conditions. And so the geologists know the past of this Sierra in Nevada. In one strata of this geological pancake that was being peeled away, must be 40 years ago now, more than 40 years ago, was found a number of mortars and pestles, quite a large number. Now, what are mortars and pestles? Mortars and pestles are, they're like stone bowls, beautifully carved out, and pestle is something where you grind something up. It's like you see the representations of it in a druggist's shop today.
Right.
Where they would take the old bowl and they would mix up something, you know, herbs and things like that. And some of the pestles they found in the Sierra, the Nevada Sierra, were very beautifully, well, actually all of them very beautifully made, especially the pestles, the handles that you use to grind up things. Well, the problem is, first of all, they could identify it with no culture known in that area whatsoever. They did look very Near Eastern, but that's about all. But the thing that they knew for sure, without a shadow of a doubt, that these mortars and pestles, by the dozens, maybe more, but at least by the dozens, go back 9 million years. Now, how is that possible? Because our species evolved less than, you know, maybe 2 million years ago. Modern man, really, I mean, what you and I are, we really only date to maybe, you know, 50,000 years.
Yeah.
And here you have evidence for beautifully made mortars and pestles that are 9 million years old. How is that explained? And it's in North America. It has never been explained. It has never been touched. The evidence is still there. A few have discussed it. No one has been able to dismiss it. And that's not the only one. There are others, but I don't, like I say, address them in this book. But that is the oldest that I was able to find for evidence in North America. And in places in South America, you find things at least as old. And they are found by sometimes mainstream archaeologists like Louis Armigino. Armigino has a crater on the moon named after him. He was Argentina's greatest anthropologist. He found things like that to go back millions of years.
Yeah.
So something is wrong. Either the geology is wrong, our interpretations are wrong, who knows? But there, you asked what evidence is, and that's hard evidence. It's hard. It's not been able to have been dismissed after all this time. And
yeah,
when you connect it in with...
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, yeah.
I was going to say, Mike Cremo has a whole book of stuff like that where they have skeletons that are found in various sediment layers that are millions of years old. And these are modern Homo sapiens sapiens. So
Yes.
Yeah.
You're right. Michael Cremo has done just the most important work in this direction. Certainly not myself. I relied upon him for a lot of this great stuff. He has devoted his lifetime to showing this stuff. So if you want to go back in time, there's some real problems with our accepted understanding of human origins.
Yeah.
The earliest that we go back in the lost history of ancient America more accessibly is really to about where the peanut is introduced in the American Southwest. That's more than 4,000 years ago. So somebody more than 4,000, to give you an idea, 4,000 years ago, okay, that's it's like about 2000, between 2000 and 2500 BC. This is the Middle Bronze Age. This is when, this is before Rome was founded, before Greece got going, when Egypt and Troy were the great powers in the Hittite Empire of the world. And yet somebody was here. Somebody was in North America who had this elite, at that time, gourmet crop, planting it. the American Southwest.
Let me ask you about that just for a second. Then I'm going to ask you one more question, and then that'll be it for our show. But on these peanuts, and I remember well when Jimmy Carter was the president, his brother was a peanut farmer, or maybe Jimmy was a peanut farmer. I can't remember which one was. But are peanuts naturally occurring in Georgia and in the South? Do they just kind of grow naturally, and then they replant them to create crops, or how did they get there? Were they planted, or were they there naturally?
The peanuts there in the United States now, of course, have long since spread all over, but they were genetically made. They're genetically programmed.
Right.
Originally, they were crossbred, and so when they were introduced here to the United States and then recognized, especially when pioneers pushed forward, and that's another interesting thing. Pioneers were shocked to see the peanut growing wild in the American Southwest,
mm-hmm.
and because they had presumed that they were the first modern people inhabiting that part of the world. And they were,
right.
And yet here they're finding peanuts all over the place. So they presumed it must have been, the Spaniards must have come through here at one time. But they didn't. The Spaniards had not gone through that area. So they then spread it all over, and they eventually just forgot about it and got on with other things. But nonetheless, the peanut is naturally occurring now, of course, in modern times, and is growing all over.
That's pretty cool. Hey, the last thing I want to talk about, and this has always been an interesting subject for me, is the crystal skulls. Now, the Maya seem to have been either the inheritors of these sophisticated skulls, or in some early generations of their people, they created these skulls. And you talk about this skull, and as I'm going to call it what you described it as today, Cotocy crystal skull in Mexico.
Coyolxauhqui. That's Aztec moon goddess that was reproduced by these crystal skulls. The crystal skulls all represent the moon goddess. And the Maya called her Ixchel. The Aztecs call her Coyolxauhqui. It means the same thing. It means the white lady. And refers to the moon.
Yeah, and what's unique about them is, and I'm referring to the Mitchell Hedges famous crystal skull that was found in Central America years ago, turn of the century.
Yeah.
When they flash lights into these things, there's photos and images that come up. Some of them shoot light back. Tell us a little bit about this skull and why it's unique. I've never seen it before, and I actually posted it on the Facebook page for people to look at. Go ahead.
Well, I was very privileged to be with the crystal skull several times. I knew Anna Mitchell Hedges before she passed away. She was about 103 when she passed away. So I was really fascinated by this object for quite a few years. I still am, of course. It's probably the most magnificent single object I've seen in my whole life. And I've been around the world. I've seen a lot of cool stuff. But the Anna Mitchell Hedges skull is something which is beyond compare. There are a number of these crystal skulls that are out there today, and they're all interesting, but they don't compare to the high-quality workmanship that went into this miraculous piece of work. Nobody knows exactly where it was found. Anna Mitchell Hedges claims it was found in Belize. That appears to be an error of some kind. So its origins are pretty much unknown. It's probably somewhere in Mexico. We don't know. The only thing I can say about it is that it is a representation of a female skull. We now know this because a forensic reconstruction of the crystal skull was attempted by Dr. Clyde Snow, and in working with the head of the coroner's office in Cook County in Chicago. So they did a very accurate forensic reconstruction of the crystal skull. And the information was sent to Frank Domingo, who is the forensic artist at the New York City Police Department. So all the people involved in this forensic reconstruction were really competent, the top of their class. And so we have a drawing, an illustration, not a sculpture, an illustration that was made of the face of the crystal skull. And it represents a a female, a woman who looks kind of Amerindian, but like she has some other genetic heritage at work in her, kind of interesting. But the very fact that working in quartz crystal, which is almost as hard as a diamond on the Mohs scale, a diamond is 10, quartz crystal is 8, to create an image so accurately of a specific human skull is in itself a miraculous achievement. And why would anybody in the ancient time go to the trouble of taking a specific skull of a particular person and then rendering it, making it so anatomically correct that thousands of years later, modern scientists could really recreate the face of the crystal skull?
Right.
So the crystal skull is an actual model of a specific skull. It must have belonged to a very important woman, and they wanted to memorialize her some way, or perhaps a sacrifice. Who knows? We don't know that. The crystal skull has many very bizarre qualities. If you, for example, if you look directly into its eyes, you can see nothing at all. You're just looking into crystal. However, if you turn the skull around and you look directly into the base of the back of the skull, the very end of the skull, you can look through the crystal skull and out through the eyes. You can read if you take the crystal skull and you place it over a newspaper, a single word will be hugely enlarged at the top of the crystal skull. It's really very strange.
Pretty weird.
If you shoot laser light into it, it diffracts in every conceivable direction and in different colors. If you take it, the first time I visited Anna Mitchell Hedges and she showed the crystal skull to me, she picked it up on her hands and she put it over a votive candle, and the skull turned absolutely blood red. It like sucked all the red out of the candle and turned entirely red, except for the very top of the skull. Very strange.
Very strange.
Tell
us a little bit about this skull that you feature in the book, though. This amazing smaller skull that's been carved with this elegant, it's beautifully carved. It's very precision carved graph of some figure. It's just amazing.
This is a much smaller, a totally different skull. It was found fairly recently, I think only a few decades ago, and it was definitely found in Mexico. All these crystal skulls, they seem to come from Central America or Mexico for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And this skull does not represent the moon goddess Coyoacauhqui. This represents instead Coatlicue. Coatlicue was the earth mother of the Aztecs. And we know that because at the top of the skull, the cranial area, uppermost area, is carved a representation of Coatlicue. And it's a magnificent, beautifully worked art. It's about the size of an ostrich egg. It's very heavy. I think with these skulls, if nothing else, they show the terrific technological grasp of the ancients, that these were not just primitive peoples who were, a very low level of society compared to us. I would find it virtually, if not completely, impossible to reproduce something like this Coatlicue skull that's featured in the book. Again, working with quartz crystal is... it's like trying to carve all these intricate designs into a diamond. It's virtually impossible. First of all, we mostly lack the industrial capacity to do such work, and certainly the artistic ability to do something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, on the Anna Mitchell skull, some tool marks have been found, and those tool marks, yes, and some of the tool marks are equivocal. Some people wonder if maybe they might be modern or maybe the ancients used a kind of a high technology. But along with those tool marks have been found other tool marks that show they were made with fire-hardened wooden dowels. In other words, if you take a certain wood and you burn it in a certain way because it gets very hard, and the eyes of the crystal skull, we know for sure, were made with these handmade with these dowels that were drilled in such a fashion that you could, over a very long period of time, create these optically correct eyes, by the way. The eyes on the crystal skull are not just holes or an approximation of octopodal pits. they are as close to being the original as conceivably possible. And that was done by hand with these wooden dowels.
Yeah, just fantastic. That's just one of the many, many stories in this wonderful book, The Lost History of Ancient America, by our edited by our guest today, Frank Joseph. Frank, thank you so much for joining us. This is a fun book to read. And do you have a website people can go and read more about this kind of material and what you're been what you're up to? You can give us.
Oh, sure. They can just go to the Ancient American website, which is www.ancientamerican.com, all lowercase, one word. And you can see the latest discoveries taking place and find out about back issues of our magazine. It's a small magazine, but it is a well-focused one and a pretty competent one, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic magazine, well edited, and there's just tons of material in there. So I do suggest that you who are listening check that out. It's a really fun, fun magazine. Again, The Lost History of Ancient America. We just touched on a few items. It's got a ton of other material in it. You can get it on Amazon right now, and I think it's also digital. So if you don't want to have the hard copy, you can look at it on your computer, on your laptop, or on your cell phone. Frank, as always, a pleasure. It's wonderful to have you, and I look forward to having you on the program in the future.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. It's great. I really enjoy our conversations, and I hope our listeners found it as interesting as I did.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. All right, we'll be back with you some other time in the future. Take care.
Okay.
So that was Frank Joseph, and he's a prolific writer. Just do a search on Amazon, and he's written – we've had him on. He spoke about Atlantis one time, and then we had him on when we first launched the show, speaking on other ancient – I think it was ancient cultures, actually. So he's always fun to have on the program, a real great researcher. I want to remind you that this program is sponsored by Gaia. And Gaia has a special program for Earth Ancient listeners to check out. If you go to gaia.com/ancient Earth Ancients, you can check out a special page that was created just for you, the listener. And this page is filled with special series on pyramids, ancient sacred geometry, sacred healing, sacred wisdom, ancient wisdom, and there's a really fun new program on discoveries made about NASA. NASA doesn't appear to be too up and up with what they're doing, and when they launch their craft, be it a satellite or manned projects into space, they sometimes attach certain tests and other performance programs into space that we don't really know about. And this this series that is on the Gaia website is fascinating. So if you go on the gaia.com/Earth Ancients, you can read about this. And they're offering a special program. Actually, you don't want to read about it. You actually see it in a killer video. Tons of really good videos. That's why I really like these guys. For 99 cents, you get the first month to check out, and it's a ton of stuff to check out. And then after that, it's just $9.95 a month. And they are constantly updating this. And this NASA series is just one of many series on space and what's going on in space that they don't want you really to know about. I really like the Graham Hancock specials that are on there. And many of our presenters, many of our guests on this program are featured on Gaia. So go to gaia.com/Earth Ancients, and you can get that special package. Just 99 cents for the first month. Check it out. Okay, that's it for today's program. Just as a reminder, next week we have Nick Redfern on the program, and his new book, Weapons of the Gods, is fascinating. And we've talked a little bit about some of the evidence of ancient nuclear explosions in India. but he gets into other parts of the world where there's evidence of very, very powerful detonations and other types of weapons that have been exploded that are now coming up because we have the technology to actually scan various parts of the surface of our planet. And what he will reveal is fascinating. That's next week on Earth Ancients, Weapons of the Gods. All right, take care. Have a great day.